We're going to continue speaking about the Mahabharata. Yeah. Revolution, routinization, open aggression. So, invasion of the earth. How many of you saw Men in Black? Movie? Any of you seen that? Yeah. Anyway, something like that. It's something like sort of a combination of Men in Black, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. Same basic ideas presented in an ancient context. So, there's a philosophical point that I wanted to bring up. One of the important stories in the Mahabharata takes place two generations before the Great War, the Great Battle of Kurukshetra. There is a king named Shantanu. That probably's not the book. But anyway, he was the king of the Kuru dynasty. Kuru dynasty is the most important dynasty back then. It's located just a little bit northeast of what is now Delhi, the capital of India. So actually for many, many thousands of years, that particular region of India, in the center of India to the north, near approximately in the area of modern Delhi, that area has tended to be a political center off and on. At times, the political center was farther to the west in the ancient Vedic period. Then it moved to the east during certain empires, like the Mauryan Empire, the Gupta Empire, let's say from around, about 300 BCE to about 300 or 400 CE, that period. But anyway, so the Kurus were the dominant political military dynasty during the time of the Mahabharata. And there was a great king named Shantanu who married, this is the point here, who married Ganga. Ganga is a goddess, and the way we write this English word Ganga is Ganges. So during the period of the Mahabharata, the Ganges is the probably the single most important sacred river. And so what does it mean to say that a great king named Kuru married a river goddess? And of course, from the skeptical point of view, it's very easy to explain. All these gods and goddesses don't actually exist. And so then the question arises, why would people who are normally, let's say, sane human beings that can actually build nice buildings and take care of their families and grow crops and do all kinds of sort of rational, normal human things, why would they be disposed to this type of delusion, this belief in things that don't exist? For example, let's say one of you is absolutely convinced that there was a big purple rabbit right here to my left, and that rabbit at any moment might pounce upon you. And let's say that there really isn't a big purple rabbit to my left, then that would be, nowadays we would call it a medical issue. And I'd probably very discreetly refer you to the appropriate student health center and so on and so forth. So if you think about it, believing that something exists when it actually doesn't exist is an illusion. And so what I want to look at now is not the specific details, like, is there really a rain god named Zeus? Is his name really Zeus? Is he really married to a lady named Hera? And so on and so forth. And did they really participate in the Battle of Troy exactly as Homer imagined it? Or is so-and-so the only son of God, or so-and-so, and so on. In other words, there are specific claims. There are specific claims saying that there is a god or there are gods and goddesses, or a goddess, or some other divine figure, a son of God, a prophet, you know, an avatar, whatever. So there are specific detailed claims. But what I want to look at with you is not merely the details, like are these particular details accurate? Is this the real name of a real person? Does he actually look like that? Does he have a beard, the way Homer describes it, or so on? But that's kind of like an ethnographic issue, like looking at specific detailed claims. I think what's more interesting, at least at the moment, for me right now, in this context, is to look at the general philosophical claim, or the metaphysical claim. So we can just put aside, for example, sectarian beliefs that the rain god is Zeus. No, it's Indra. No, it's Thor. But, you know, in every language people have their different names, or artistically they may depict gods and goddesses in different ways. But we put all that aside and look at the basic claim that in the universe, in this universe, there are powerful beings with extraordinary power, at least that means more than ordinary human beings, who have power beyond our own, and somehow or other these beings are engaged in regulating, governing what we call the forces of nature. So, if you put aside the details, what we find is that people all around the world, frankly, people all around the world, up until the somewhat violent, and at times extremely violent, spreading of traditions coming from the Middle East. In other words, with the spread of Christianity and Islam as world religions, sometimes by persuading and attracting people, often by almost unprecedented violence, you know, depending on the circumstances, and with the Middle Eastern, a type of, well, not Middle Eastern, but a Judaic, Islamic, and you could even say Christian, frequently a hostility toward the notion that there are divine beings in the universe. So a type of jealous monotheism. I mentioned this form of jealous monotheism because there are other forms of monotheism. For example, there's lots of monotheism in India. But it tended not to be jealous in the sense that the idea was that just as a great king has many ministers and servants and all kinds of people working under him, or a great queen, so God, conceived of as a supreme sovereign, may, at his or her or their or its discretion, empower other living beings to perform certain cosmic functions. So that just as, for example, if you have a very high position within the federal government, you may be given certain privileges and powers, like you can carry a concealed weapon, or you may be allowed to arrest people, or you may be allowed to pull switches that release tons of water through a dam, for example, flooding certain regions, whereas ordinary people can't pull that lever, or can't carry a concealed weapon, or can't arrest people, and so on and so forth. And so just as the reason I'm making this argument is not to persuade you that there are such beings, but just to level the playing field and to expose a type of skeptical prejudice, which is not actually based on real evidence or logic. It simply happens to be the intellectual predisposition of certain people nowadays who consider themselves to be scholars. So, the idea is that if you look at the general claim, I mean, how do we actually know that there are or are not powerful beings? So just as in an ordinary government, certain people are given extraordinary powers to represent a government. For example, if a secret agent protecting the president of this country is allowed certain extraordinary powers, that doesn't mean that person is the president. If that person comes to believe I am the president because I have a concealed weapon, or I can give people karate chops or something, then obviously the person doesn't get it. So to say that certain people are given extraordinary powers to God is not to make a polytheistic claim. That is not polytheism. And if you look at, for example, the arguments of Paul of Tarsus in the New Testament, he tends to equate a multiplicity of divine beings with polytheism. In other words, the denial that there's one God. And Paul, I mean, if you look at the Old Testament, actually, there are lists of different gods who existed in the Middle East at that time, saying that in the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. The actual claim was that there are different gods, if you speak to very distinguished Old Testament scholars, but that you've got to get them in the right order. The more radical claim, which was made by Paul, which was made by Islam, and made by other and certain Jewish groups, the more radical claim that the gods actually don't exist, that there is no such thing. There really is only one divine being in the universe. In other words, it's a government of one sovereign, and there's no cabinet, there are no ministers, there's nothing. There's only one sovereign being. So, to believe or not to believe that there's a multiplicity of divine beings, or you could just say powerful beings in the universe, somehow engaged in the administration of the universe, that says nothing about whether you are a monotheist or a polytheist in and of itself. And so, I mean, well, I have to say ad nauseum. Every book I've ever read that talks about, like, why did otherwise sort of reasonable, functional human beings come to believe something as silly as that behind the forces of nature, there are powerful beings. Like, why would apparently reasonable people believe that? I've only seen one answer, I mean, in my very short and young life. I've only seen one real answer to that question in an academic book, and that is because back then, people, in their innocence and their ignorance, witnessed the power of nature, the thunderbolts and lightning and torrential rains and droughts and earthquakes and cyclones, etc., and being naturally afraid of these things, then sort of somewhere in their deep unconscious wheel started turning that if someone is in charge of these things and we can somehow placate, propitiate, make a deal with these people, that maybe we can somehow be safe. And so therefore, they simply imagine. They concocted, they created simply out of their imagination the idea that there are powerful beings in the universe, and they began to make offerings to figments of their own imagination. In other words, these people were seriously deluded. They were basically, I mean, it borders on pathopsychology, but it made them feel good about themselves, and so whatever. So somehow it's genetically selected because it made people feel good about themselves. So, I have to say that, in my view, there is something almost incredibly naive about this. Because, first of all, let's say you go to graduate school. And basically in graduate school, you'll never guess what you do there. You write papers and read books and take tests and listen to lectures. Surprise, surprise. So, I mean, I went through that process, and for the life of me, I can't figure out how, in the process of reading books, like the ones you're reading, and taking tests, and writing papers, and listening to lectures, how I would discover the ultimate truths of the universe. Simply by doing that. Because to say there are, or are not, gods, or beings, goddesses behind the forces of nature, is a religious claim. It's a religious claim. It's not an academic claim. I mean, I explained that in the beginning. If you say, for example, here's a claim. This is a truth claim. Or, let's say someone makes this claim. Or this claim. Or this claim. You know what that means, it doesn't equal, right? I mean, you all have to take it to your... Yeah, a math test to get into UF or something. So, I mean, here you have a positive claim which is true. So we'll say this claim is positive and true. This claim is negative and untrue. Well, I'm actually using a minus symbol here. The reason I mention all this is because people that generally write books about religion don't take courses in logic and epistemology. And therefore, they very freely use words like probably, and we now know, or we believe that, and this is not coming from a serious understanding of logic and epistemology. It's coming from a type of, if I may say it, groupthink. Because it's just like if you go into a very devout church and you say Jesus is Lord, it's like, and? Like, we know that. If you go into a very devout, really committed church and say Jesus is not Lord, it's like, what are you talking about? So it's just the nature of human communities that they tend to develop certain common beliefs. And if you say something which is outside that belief system, you're challenged. So it is intellectually respectable. It is intellectually respectable in our country, in general, in the world, in an academic setting, to be skeptical about a religious belief, but it is not intellectually respectable to believe it. So in a public university, if you claim that, let's say, Zeus is the god of rain, you'll basically be terminated. But if you say, this was a bunch of people just saw thunder and lightning and, you know, got real scared, so they projected their own human forms and everything onto some being they imagined, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with saying that. That in no way, you know, threatens the division between church and state. So here's a negative claim which is untrue. Here is a positive claim which is untrue. And here is a positive... No. A negative claim. Whoops. Which is true. Why did I just... I don't even know why I wrote all that. Anyway, so what I mean to say is any one of these claims is equally a mathematical statement. This is all math. Now, some of it's correct and some of it's not correct, but all of these statements are within the domain of mathematics. So in the same way, let's say Indra, the Hindu god, Vedic god of rain and thunder and lightning. Indra is the god of rain. Indra is not the god of rain. And so on and so forth. Those are equally religious claims. Those are equally religious claims. So the reason I mention this is because I don't believe it's actually ethical or logical or rational within an academic setting to claim that this is God or this isn't God. Because how would you know? If someone says this is God or this isn't God, in both cases they are claiming to know ultimate truths about the universe. These are not academic statements, they're religious claims. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with religious claims, and, it's a free country. You can have all the religious claims you want, positive or negative, but they should not be disguised as scholarship. We should make a clear distinction. This is scholarship, this is my religion. Skepticism, metaphysical skepticism, to hold a negative view of divine things, is a religious position. It's not an academic position. It's a religious position. Anyway, I don't want to belabor this point, but I just want to sort of... What I'm trying to do is obviously trying to vaccinate you against a lot of the unfairness that actually goes on in the name of scholarship. So, having exploited my position here to get all that out. So what does it mean? What does it mean in the Mahabharata when it says that Bhima married Ganga? Ganga, of course, that's the original name, which in English the British wrote as Ganges.
Bhima?
Bhishma. I'm sorry, Shantanu. The king Shantanu married Ganga. So what does it mean? I mean, I think it's interesting to think, rather than just like sort of throw this out like, no, it's just imagination. What does it mean to identify a lady, a goddess, with a river? And back in ancient India, people didn't think that he married a bunch of water. It's not that, you know, at the marriage ceremony, on the one side was this great king, the other side was a bunch of water. And then the water spoke. I mean, no one thought that. Ganga has a very beautiful human-like form and divine powers, according to this understanding. So what does it mean that she's the goddess of the river? And this is a question that's not really asked so much, but I think it's actually an interesting question. What were people thinking back then? Because they knew that she wasn't just water, and yet somehow she's the goddess of the water. Or the god of... I mean, think in America, for example, that like there's an electrical grid around here after the lights go on, and someone actually is in charge of that. Someone built it. Someone designed it. And so, let's say the person in charge of electricity is not him or herself, electricity. But anyway, this is the general view that behind all the forces of nature, there are conscious, powerful beings managing it. So that's the general view. So now I'll get to the story. Are there any questions about all this stuff I just threw at you? Yes?
About mortals varying divinities?
Yes.
Don't divinities have more important things to do, like their duties? Why would they marry, like, regular humans?
Okay. Maybe they met on a website or something. So, cosmic singles. Anyway, the general view here is that back in previous ages, human beings were much more elevated and had more intercourse with celestial beings. And sometimes you could say celestial beings would marry down or were attracted to certain very powerful human beings. I mean, after all, look at Tolkien, right? That elf girl that gave up her immortality to marry the king. So it happens. Even in Middle Earth. Yes?
The fact that he was marrying a goddess, this is something that's accepted in the book. Was it necessarily accepted, like, at the time? I mean, do we know that everyone actually thought that he was marrying a goddess at the time? I mean, I know you said that that's, like, a skeptical point of view. But, like, on more of, like, I understand that people believe it now.
Right.
People really
well, that's a valid question. Of course, the text that we have, the Mahabharata, is composed by generally Brahmins who consider that all these things actually happened. And I guess I can only say that within the tradition, within the text tradition, there is very little anything that you could call skepticism. So that you have a civilization that seemed to accept that these things actually happened in a previous age and at the time. So, also, you have a civilization which didn't merely believe. I think it would be naive to say that people merely believe this. Like, for example, I mean, some of you must have seen Lord of the Rings, right? Some of you, like everyone. Okay. So you saw Lord of the Rings. Now, when you see fiction, you suspend your disbelief, right? Otherwise, you don't enjoy the movie. Like, you go into a movie, let's say you're watching Lord of the Rings, and the person next to you says, there really is no such thing as Middle Earth. That's just an actor. And that person just wearing makeup, and that person doesn't really have blonde hair. You know, it's bleached. You know, the elf archer. So, you know, the person would basically be thrown out of the theater. Because in order to get into a story, whether it's a novel, I mean, to save your life, you have to say, is this fiction or non-fiction? You get it right. You say it's fiction. But at the moment you're experiencing it, at the moment you actually go into it, it is real for you at that moment. Even though some other compartment of your brain knows this is fiction. But there's a whole other part of your brain that's just there. You're actually in Middle Earth, and that's where you want to be. And so, I mean, this raises an interesting existential sort of psychological question. That are we wired in such a way that it's possible for us to wholly embrace, so to speak, with all our hearts, people would say at movies, you know, they cry and they laugh, and emotionally you are totally engaged, you're totally there. Is it possible to get completely emotionally engaged with all your being in something which in no way is true or real? In other words, is it our nature as human beings that our mind is so powerful that we can not only imagine something which isn't true, but become completely emotionally engaged in it? So that if, for example, I mean, consider Jung, you know, the psychologist Jung, talking about the archetypes and so on. If, here's one theory, I'm presenting as a theory. Not, if it were the case that that something like this is true, that something like Middle Earth exists somewhere, or existed in the past, something like that, or in Star Wars, if something like that is true, then even though the names are changed, the forms are changed, the story is changed, but still, it actually represents, even if in an imperfect way, something that's actually real. Just like, let's say, if a child draws a picture of his or her parents, you know, like in school, crayons, the teachers have you draw pictures like that. Then, even though it's very childish, it's still recognizable in a sense. I mean, we know that the child would say, drawing, this is the sun, this is a house, that's a tree. And everyone understands what it's about. So in this sense, getting all the details right is irrelevant if it connects at a very deep level to some inner sense you have of what ultimately exists in the universe, or even something that you've experienced in some previous life. Now, I'm presenting this to you simply to show that there are other plausible, whether it's true or not, it's your choice, but that the skeptical view of things is not the only possible way the universe could exist. There are other ways to look at it, and ultimately I feel in a university you should be presented with different perspectives, treated like adults, and allowed to make your own choice about what you think is real or not real. In other words, it's not that you should be indoctrinated here in a particular academic dogma, such as skepticism, but rather simply informed that here are different ways that people have looked at these things, and now you have to make your own choice.
Can I make a few comments about your last comment about the skepticism? I mean, there is a deep misunderstanding about scientific community outside the scientific community. For example, the science physicists will tell you that we only know 5% of the universe. We don't even...
That's a very big number, I think.
Yeah, 5%. That's a small number.
And no. I think that's a very, that's really highballing to say they know 5% of the universe.
We visible. I mean, they know that 95% of the universe exists. I mean, it's exerting some force, but we don't know. So physicists are very, very clear that we don't know about something called dark energy, which is supposed to be 70% of the universe, and 25% is called dark matter. We don't know. We can't see it, but we know it exists. And so what I'm trying to make is that scientific community will tell you, okay, we know something, we don't know something. But the problem with the religious community is they tend to speak in absolutes without being sure. And that's why there is this skepticism towards the religious claims as a thing of scientific. And you want to answer?
Yeah, but I think that ultimately we simply have to be fair-minded. In other words, if someone says, I believe that this is God, that's clearly a religious claim. It may be true, maybe not true. But at least we have it in the right category. It's a religious claim. So if someone says this is not God, that's also a religious claim. And so I'm saying just put things in the right box. That's all that I'm saying. Put things in the right box. So, any other points on this? Anyway, so what happened? Shantanu married Ganga, and they had a son named Devavrata, who then Ganga left him. Ganga left Shantanu because she, I guess, sort of got tired of living on the earth and wanted to go back to where she's from. It's a celestial realm. And the king was depressed. You know, he lost this goddess. I mean, men often believe they've fallen in love with a goddess. The belief doesn't always persist after a certain amount of time, but in this case, he actually did marry a goddess. And so he was depressed and wandering about and ran into another very beautiful young girl. Years later, ran into this very beautiful young girl from a fishing community named Satyavati. And he fell in love with her, and she fell in love with him. But even though he was this great king, when he went to her father, who was the head of a fishing village, he didn't want to give his permission to marry her. This says something very interesting about civilization back then. He's an emperor. He's this very, very powerful king who could totally annihilate this guy in the fishing village. And yet again, following Dharma, following this principle of virtue, even though he's in love, he's very attached, he wants to marry this girl, he's the emperor of the world, he can't marry her without the father's permission. And if you look at some stories we get from other parts of the world, he just basically cut the guy's head off or just take the girl anyway. But this is a very interesting story where he will not take the girl without the father's permission. There's a certain level of dharma, virtue here. So he goes back to his kingdom, his capital, Hastinapur, and he's depressed because he's in love with this girl and he's lonely and he's been living for some time without a wife. So his son, Devavrata, by now sort of a strapping teenager, very powerful guy who sort of has extraordinary martial power, and sees his father depressed. And he says to his father, why are you depressed? The father says, well, I only have one son, And, you know, being a warrior is a very dangerous profession. We have to keep the dynasty going, and they say that one son is like no son. So we have to guarantee your dynasty will be preserved. So the son's bright, and he goes to the ministers and says, what's really going on here? What's wrong with my father? And they tell him, your father's in love, and he can't marry this girl because the father won't give permission. And the reason the father won't give permission, it turns out, is because of David Bratta, the son. The fishing guy fears that if I give my daughter and then you have a child by my daughter, a son, that son will be in danger because your first son may kill him, or my son will never have a kingdom. So David Bratta goes to the fisherman and says that give your daughter to my father. I want my father to be happy. And in return, I will give up the kingdom. So he loves his father so much, he's willing to give up the kingdom. So then the fisher says that, fisherman says, well, that's all well and good. You may not have the kingdom, but what about your son? Your son may claim the kingdom. So then David Bratta makes this sort of this terrible vow. He says he will never marry. He will never have a woman. And he's a warrior. He's a passionate warrior. He's not some sage in the forest. So he gives up any possibility of material happiness. And it said this vow was so, like, such a frightening vow that his name was changed to Bhishma by the gods, which means awesome, which used to be a regular English word. Awesome or like frightening. And so then the king marries this girl, Satyavati, has two children, Chitrangada and Chitravirya. But what happens is that the older son, then the Shantanu, eventually retires and passes away. His son, Chitrangada, takes over the kingdom. But it turns out there's a Gandharva elf, like in Lord of the Rings. There's a Gandharva that has the same name, Chitrangada, sort of accosts this Kuru prince and says, hey man, you got to change your name. Because like I'm the only one in this neighborhood that can use that name. And so the Kuru king's very, prince very proud, says no way. So they step outside and they have a fight. And the Gandharva wins. And the Kuru prince is killed. So now the kingdom goes to his younger brother, the Chitravirya. So Bhishma, Bhishma, the first son, wants to get his kid brother, stepbrother, married. So he goes to Kashi. He hears there's a Swayamvara. Swayamvara means sort of a royal wedding where the girl, the princess, could create these fantastic conditions, and then all the great princes of the world would compete for her hand to see who was the most valorous, who was the bravest. And so there's a Swayamvara for three princesses of Kashi, which is now Banaras in India. And the three girls are named Amba, Ambikan, and Ambalika, which if you know Spanish is like Amba, Ambita, and Ambitita. It's like Amba, and little bitty Amba. So, anyway, these are three very beautiful, beautiful princesses. They're supposed to have this competition. Bhishma, the one who's vowed never to marry, is so powerful. He just rides in to this event, puts the girls on his chariot, and starts to ride off. And the other princes are saying, what are you doing? So literally all the princes attack him, and he's so powerful, he fights them all off, smashes them, and takes the girls back to Hastinapur for his kid brother. So then when they get back there, and the girls are not really, I mean, at least the two younger ones, Ambika and Ambalika, are not really too unhappy because to marry into the Kuru dynasty is like, that's as good as it gets. And Vichitravirya is a really good-looking guy, and so, worse things can happen to a princess. But Amba, the oldest sister, tells Bhishma privately that actually I was already in love with some other prince. And we'd already arranged that he was going to take me away. It was a prince named Shalva. And I'm in love with him. And he's in love with me. And, you kind of messed everything up. So Bhishma thinks, oh boy. So then he says, you can go back to Shalva. Obviously I don't want you to, I can't marry you to my younger brother if you're in love with someone else. So this girl, Amba, this princess, goes to Shalva, thinking that he's going to be amazed and ecstatic that she was so faithful to him, she was true to him, that she actually got away from the Kuru simply out of love for him, that she gave up this highest position. Shalva, who's not a nice guy, it turns out. You know, she's not the first girl to make that mistake. Shalva says that, look, you spent a few days over there. You slept over in the palace of the Kurus. You were under the control of Bhishma. He grabbed your hand. He put you on the chariot. This is a very, very strict society. And how do I know what you did there? And she was begging him to believe that she was faithful to him. And he's kind of a jerk. And he won't believe her. And he just rejects her. So she goes back to Bhishma. She goes back to Bhishma and says, Shalva won't accept me. And now I have no choice. I have to marry your brother. And you have to understand, this is a society which is like every traditional ancient society. Where if someone in her position didn't... You know, here she spent time in the Kuru palace. She's been under the control of these men. Now she spent time in Shalva's palace. She's away from her family. If Bhishma rejects her, she's socially dead. That no one will have her. And so she begs Bhishma, and then he also doesn't believe her. She's actually telling the truth, and no one will believe her. So Bhishma doesn't believe that she was actually chaste, and he won't accept her for his younger brother. He won't marry her himself, because he's vowed not to marry her. So at this point, here's a girl, this beautiful young girl, who from the time she was born was raised as a real-life princess. Intelligent, beautiful, cultured, you know, never had a problem in life. Her life is all planned out. You'll marry a great king. You'll have a great life. Suddenly, she's falling through the cracks, and she's like, she's in an absolute crisis, and no one will accept her. And so she's also a warrior girl. I mean, she's not a just like a nerd. She's a warrior princess. And so when she sees what's happening, she gets really, really, really angry. And she sees how she's being abused and treated this way, and she's had it because she realized she's finished now. No one will have her, and so. People tell her, just go back to your family, but she feels, obviously, that no one's going to believe me, so I'm not going to go back there to be humiliated. So she goes out to the forest. She goes out to the forest and finds a group of elderly ascetics, yogis, and she decides that she's going to perform the most severe austerities in the book, in the yoga book, until she gets the power she wants, and she's going to kill Bhishma for ruining her life. And that's exactly what she does. And so Bhishma, meanwhile, has the spies out, because these are big world leaders. And so and everyone's trying to dissuade her, like, go home to your family, don't do this. And this beautiful princess turns herself into this absolute ascetic. You know, it's just their hair, and she just emaciates her body. And then there's this very powerful scene in Mahabharata where she performs these frightening austerities, and her last words before she gives up her life with all this power she's acquired is Bhishmasya Vadhaya, to the death of Bhishma. And she dies. And she will actually take birth in her next life as a very powerful warrior named Shikhandi, who in the great battle of Kurukshetra will actually kill Bhishma. That's just one little story, which I thought was interesting. Anyway, so it's a very famous story in India. Meanwhile, back at the Kuru ranch, so Chitrangada marries the two younger princesses, and then it's said that in his youth, he was just dedicated to Dharma, but when he married these two girls, he kind of forgot himself and basically went on an endless honeymoon. And it's said that he because this is a previous age when people are very austere, he's so overindulged with these girls that he actually dissipated himself and died. And so suddenly the Kuru dynasty, for the first time in countless centuries, is thrown into an utter crisis because there's no descendant. I mean, there's no one to take the throne. And Bhishma cannot rule. Bhishma's taken his vow, and no matter what, he won't break his word. So the Kuru dynasty is threatened with extinction. And Satyavati, remember Satyavati, who married Shantanu, her two sons are now dead, she's panicking because she's trying to keep the dynasty going, this great ancient dynasty. And so she goes to Bhishma and she orders him as a queen mother and pleads with him that, never mind your vow, you should accept the two widows of Vichitravirya and give them sons so that this dynasty is not destroyed. And he absolutely won't do it. I mean, you know, he gives a famous speech where even if, you know, all the world collapse, I won't break my vow. He's sort of an act-based ethicist in the sense that, you know, rather than a consequentialist, never mind the consequences, the act itself is the locus of ethical truth. Anyway, so Bhishma won't do it. Bhishma won't get married. And Satyavati is beside herself. And then she finally reveals a secret in her own life. Satyavati reveals a secret in her own life. And that is that when she was a young girl, a young maiden, she actually had another child. It's like, whoa. And the story is that when she was a young girl, and there's a whole other story I don't have time for, that Satyavati was actually born as a princess, but for various reasons was concealed in the fishing village. But anyway, when she was a young girl, she used to row a boat across the Jamuna River, you know, for a little extra income stream for her father. And I told you this last time, Parashar Muni, this great sage, took a ride in the river and saw she was very beautiful and had a mission to bring an avatar into the world and somehow understood she was meant to be the mother of this avatar. And so he persuaded her for the sake of the world to just do it. And they had a child. They had a child, Vyasa, who is the great compiler of the Vedas and who takes part in the Mahabharata story. So there was a law called Devara. There was a law, a Sanskrit law called Devara, which was that if a man dies and leaves widows, and if there's an absolute necessity that the woman have children, that a brother may give her, the man's brother may give her children, or that in their cases, in royal dynasties, to keep a dynasty from going extinct, a great Brahmin is allowed to be a surrogate father to give children to a queen or a princess, and those children are counted within the dynasty by Dharma. So she says that my son, Vyasa, is the greatest Brahmin on earth. And he gave me the boon, my son, that if I simply remember him, he'll come to me. And so Bhishma agrees, and Satyavati simply remembers him, he appears before her, and he agrees to give sons to the widows of her son. So what happens now, and here's a crucial point in the story. Vyasa, urges Satyavati, let these two widows, let them practice a spiritual discipline for 1 year, because the state of their consciousness will determine the sons they get. And this is a general principle in the Vedic culture, the state of the consciousness of the mother will have a huge influence in the kind of child, the consciousness of the child that comes into her womb. And so Satyavati was so impatient to save the dynasty, she said, there's no time for that. So Vyasa basically said, okay, I'm not responsible. So it was arranged, and one night he went into the first princess, Ambika. And because she was a princess and sort of pampered all her life, and he was this mountain sage, his appearance kind of frightened her. And so when he came to her, as he was beginning a child in her, she shut her eyes. And she refused to look at him. And therefore, her son was born blind. And so that son, of course, is the famous Dhritarashtra, the blind king. Then, Vyasa went a second time to the younger sister, and she knew what happened to her older sister, so she kept her eyes open. But still, it was like so frightening for her that she just went completely pale. So her son was born powerful but pale. So he was called Pandu, which means whitish. And then Satyavati wanted one more son with the first lady, but she said, she thought, I can't do this. And so therefore she dressed up her maidservant in her own clothes. And then Vyasa came, and Vyasa knew exactly who it was. He was a great sage. And he got a child. And she, interestingly, this maidservant was actually the one who most respected the sage, who was kindest to the sage. And therefore her son became the wisest of all the Kurus, Vidura. Anyways, these three sons were born. At that point, Vyasa said, I'm out of here. So Vyasa was gone. The blind Dhritarashtra could not rule because he was blind, and therefore because the king had to personally lead the troops, personally defend the realm, and so the kingdom went to Pandu. And it was this Pandu who was the father of the Pandavas, including Arjuna who heard Bhagavad Gita from Krishna. So, just a few more minutes. To make a long story short, Pandu didn't like all the luxury of the city, of the imperial capital. He used to go off and sort of camp out in the woods with his wife. He actually had two wives. He had Kunti and Madri. Anyway, he was out on one time hunting, and in a hunting accident, which is very common. There's all these hunting accidents in this literature, which is kind of a warning to say to kings not to hunt. Anyway, he accidentally killed a Brahmin who was in the act of begetting. It's a very interesting story or fable that there was a Brahmin couple who were performing severe austerities, yoga in the forest, and they did it so much that when they finally wanted to have a child, they were both frigid. You know, they couldn't do it. And so, therefore, they used their yogic power, took the form of deer, who could very easily and often do it. They took the form of deer, and then they were begetting a child with this outward form, and Pandu mistook them and shot them and killed them. And so, with his dying words, the Brahmana said that, "I will not curse you for the sin of killing a Brahmin because you couldn't recognize me, but there is a dharma." This is what they always say. There is a dharma that you should never disturb any creature that's in the act of begetting. The act of begetting is sacred. You should never be disturbed. And therefore, I do curse you that when you, if you ever try to beget a child, you will die in the act, just as you killed me in the act of begetting. So Pandu's cursed. He's very depressed that he killed a Brahmin. He retires way up in the mountains. Doesn't give up his kingdom, but just sort of goes off into the mountains, leaves everything with his brothers. And eventually, he wants children, though. So then his wife, his older wife, Kunti, reveals that when she was a young girl, she had once served a great sage named Durvasa, received a boon, a mantra, that she could call any god and have a child with this god. And so at the urging of her husband, she calls the god Indra, the head of the gods. I'm sorry, first calls Dharma, the god Dharma, and begets Yudhisthira, who will become Dharmaraj, the king of Dharma, the great king. Then she calls the wind, the most powerful god, and begets Bhima. Then she calls Indra and begets Arjuna. Her co-wife Madri borrows the boon, calls the twin gods, the Ashwins, and gets Nakul and Sahadeva. These are the five Pandavas. Anyway, what happens is that eventually the curse acts, and even though Pandu knows he can't beget, it's one spring day, his second wife Madri is dressed in a very sort of revealing way, they're out in the mountains, he becomes irresistibly attracted to her, and even though she's screaming and fighting because she knows it will kill him, he embraces her and tries, you know, to enjoy her, and he dies. There's a very touching scene where she cries out, and Kunti, the other wife, knows what it is. She just knows what it is and tells the children to go away. Anyway, so then the five boys have to go back down from the Himalayas, down into the Ganges Valley to the imperial capital of Hastinapur, where their uncle, Dhritarashtra, now by Dharma their father, begins to plot to get rid of them and to install his own son, Duryodhana, as king. And the rest of the story is this incredible intrigue where these young boys and their mother Kunti are struggling to stay alive, and they're being persecuted by this king, by his own sons, and there's all kinds of adventures. Finally comes to the great war of Kurukshetra, and it's on that battlefield that Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, the middle son of the Pandavas. And of course the Pandavas win the battle and become the rulers of the world. So that's the basic story, and anyway, for a very large number of people for a long time, this is actually sacred history. So, I guess that's it for today.